Burghers who lived there were Protestants, especially in the rich northern towns. He did all he could to make them renounce their faith, but they wouldn't give in. So he sent a Spanish nobleman to be their governor, and he was even more fanatical and inflexible than Philip himself. The Duke of Alba, with his thin, pale face, his narrow, pointed beard and icy gaze, was just the sort of warrior that Philip favoured. In cold blood, the Duke of Alba sentenced a great number of burghers and noblemen to be hanged. Finally, people could stand it no longer. There was a fierce and bloody battle, which ended in 1579 with the liberation of the Protestant towns of the Low Countries and the expulsion of the Spanish troops. Now, as free, rich, independent, and enterprising trading cities, they too could try their luck across the seas, in India and America. But King Philip II of Spain's most cruel defeat was yet to come. In England, Queen Elizabeth I, the daughter of King Henry VIII, was on the throne. Elizabeth was very clever, strong-willed, and determined, but she was also vain and cruel. She was determined to defend England against the many Catholics still present in the country, whom she persecuted relentlessly. Her cousin, Mary Stuart, the Catholic Queen of Scotland, was a woman of great beauty and charm, and she too believed she had a right to the English throne. Elizabeth had her imprisoned and executed. Elizabeth also helped the Protestant burghers of the Low Countries in their war against Philip of Spain. Philip was furious. He resolved to conquer England for Catholicism or destroy it. At immense cost, he raised a huge fleet of 130 great sailing ships with around 2,000 cannon and more than 20,000 men. It takes no time to read, but just try to imagine 130 sailing ships at sea. This was the Invincible Armada. When it set sail from Spain in 1588, loaded with heavy cannon and weaponry and food and supplies for 6 months, it seemed inconceivable that England's small island might ever succeed in resisting such a mighty force. However, the heavily laden warships were cumbersome and hard to manoeuvre. The English avoided confrontation and darted in and out in their nimbler vessels, attacking the Spanish ships. One night, they launched fireships into the midst of the Spanish fleet, creating panic and confusion, and sending them in all directions. Many ships drifted along the English coast and went down in severe gales. Barely half the armada reached home, and not one ship succeeded in landing on an English shore. Philip betrayed no sign of his disappointment. It is said that he greeted the commander of the fleet warmly and thanked him, saying, "After all, I sent you to fight men, not the wind and waves." But the English didn't only chase the Spaniards from their own waters. They attacked Spanish merchant ships off America and India, and, together with the Dutch, had soon supplanted the Spanish in many of their rich trading ports. Starting in North America, to the north of the Spanish colonies, they established trading posts, much as the Phoenicians had once done. And many Englishmen and women who had been persecuted or banished during the conflicts of religion went there to find freedom. The Indian ports and trading posts were not actually under English and Dutch rule, but were governed by merchants from those two countries who grouped together to do business and bring treasures from the Indies to Europe. These societies of merchants were known as East India Companies. They hired soldiers whom they sent inland, where they punished unfriendly natives and any who refused to part with their goods at a sufficiently low price. This treatment of India's Indians was little better than that shown by the Spanish conquistadores towards the Indians of America. In India, too, the conquest of coastal regions by English and Dutch merchants was made easier by the lack of unity among India's princes. Soon the peoples of North America and India were using the language of a small island off the northwest coast of France. That island was England. A new world empire was taking shape. At the time of the Roman Empire, Latin was the language of the world. Now the world would have to learn English. Chapter 30. Terrible Times. If I wished, I could write many more chapters on the wars between Catholics and Protestants, but I won't. It was a dreadful era. Events soon became so confused that people no longer knew why or against whom they were fighting. The Habsburg emperors of Germany, ruling now from Prague, now from Vienna, had no real power outside Austria and part of Hungary. They were pious men who wished to re-establish the sovereignty of the Catholic Church throughout their empire. Nevertheless, they did for a while allow Protestants to hold religious services, until one day a revolt broke out in Bohemia. In 1618, discontented Protestants threw three of the Emperor's Catholic councillors out of a window at Prague Castle. They landed in a pile of manure, and so came to little harm. Nevertheless, this event, known as the Defenestration of Prague, gave the signal for a dreadful war to begin which lasted for 30 years. 30 years, just imagine. If someone heard about the defenestration at the age of 10, they would have had to wait until they were 40 to experience peace, if they experienced it. For in no time the war had turned into a dreadful massacre, as hordes of ill-paid soldiers from countries far and wide rampaged through the land, looting and killing. The expectation of plunder was what drew the vilest and most brutal men of all nations into the ranks of these armies. Religious faith was long forgotten. Protestants fought in Catholic armies, Catholics in Protestant ones. Friend and foe suffered alike from their rapacity. Wherever they pitched their tents, they demanded food, and, above all, drink from the local peasants. And if a peasant refused to give them what they wanted, they took it by force, or they killed him. In their improbable patchwork of rags and their great plumed hats, swords dangling from their belts and pistols at the ready, they rode around burning, killing, and tormenting the defenseless peasantry out of sheer wickedness and depravity. Nothing could stop them. The only person they would obey was their commander, and if he won their affection, they followed him with blind devotion. One such commander on the Emperor's side was Wallenstein, a poor country nobleman of immense ambition and ability. He led his armies up into North Germany to capture the Protestant towns. Thanks to his skill and strategy, the war was nearly decided in favor of the Emperor and the Catholic Church. However, a new country entered the conflict. This was Sweden, under its powerful, pious, and Protestant ruler, Gustavus Adolphus. His aim was to rescue the Protestant faith and found a mighty Protestant empire under Sweden's leadership. The Swedes had retaken North Germany and were marching on Austria when, in 1632, the 14th year of this dreadful war, Gustavus Adolphus fell in battle. Nevertheless, many of his battalions reached the outskirts of Vienna and wrought havoc there. France also joined the war. Now you might think that the French, being Catholics, would have sided with the Emperor against the Protestants of North Germany and Sweden. But the war had long stopped being about religion. Each country was out to get what it could from the general confusion. And because the two Habsburg rulers, the Emperor of Germany and the King of Spain, were the dominant powers in Europe, the French, under the guidance of their exceptionally intelligent minister, Cardinal Richelieu, hoped to exploit the situation to make France Europe's greatest power. So that's why France's soldiers fought against those of the Emperor. Meanwhile, Wallenstein, as the Emperor's general, was at the height of his power. His army worshipped him, and his fierce soldiers fought for him and for the fulfilment of his aims, rather than for the Emperor or the Catholic faith, being indifferent to both. The effect of this was that Wallenstein increasingly saw himself as the rightful sovereign. Without him and his troops, the Emperor was powerless. So he took it upon himself to hold talks with the enemy about a possible peace agreement, and ignored all the Emperor's commands. The Emperor decided to arrest him. But in 1634, before he could do so, Wallenstein was murdered by an English captain who had once been his friend. However, the war continued for 14 more years, becoming increasingly wild and confused. Whole villages were burned, towns plundered, women and children murdered, robbed, and abducted. There seemed to be no end to it. The soldiers seized the peasants' livestock and trampled their crops. Famine, disease, and roaming packs of wolves made wastelands of great stretches of Germany. And after all these years of appalling suffering, the envoys of the various rulers finally met in 1648 and, after interminable and complicated discussions, agreed on a peace which left things more or less as they had been in the first place, before the 30 Years' War had begun. What had been Protestant would remain Protestant. The lands the Emperor controlled, Austria, Hungary, and Bohemia, would remain Catholic. With the death of Gustavus Adolphus, Sweden had lost most of the influence it had gained, and only held on to a few strips of conquered land in North Germany and on the Baltic coast. Cardinal Richelieu's envoys were alone in succeeding to secure a number of German fortresses and towns near the Rhine for France, which made the wily French minister the only true victor in a war which hadn't even concerned him. Germany was devastated. Barely half the population had survived, and those who had were destitute. Many left and made their way to America, while others tried to enlist in foreign armies, since they didn't know about anything but fighting. On top of all this misery and despair, a terrible madness began to infect a growing number of people. The fear of evil spells, of sorcery and witchcraft. People had also been superstitious in the Middle Ages, and had believed in all sorts of ghouls and ghosts, as you remember. But it was never as bad as this. Things had begun to get worse during the time of the power and splendor-loving popes, the time we know as the Renaissance, when the new St. Peter's Church was being built and indulgences were sold. Those popes weren't pious, but that only made them all the more superstitious. They were afraid of the devil and every conceivable form of magic. And each of the popes of the period around 1500, whose names we associate with the most wonderful works of art, was also responsible for chilling decrees calling for witches and sorcerers to be hunted down without mercy, especially in Germany. You may ask how it is possible to hunt down something that isn't there and never was. And that is precisely why it was so terrible. If a woman wasn't liked in her village, perhaps because she was a little odd or made people feel uncomfortable, anyone could suddenly say, "That woman's a witch. She's the cause of those hailstorms we've been having." Or, "She gave the mayor his bad back." And in fact, both in Italian and in German, people still use the expression "witch hurt" when talking about backache. Then the woman would be arrested and interrogated. They would ask her if she was in league with the devil. Naturally, she would be horrified and deny it. But then they would torture and torment her for so long and in such a dreadful way that, half dead with pain, she would admit to anything in her despair. And that was it. Now that she had confessed to being a witch, she would be burned alive. Often, while she was being tortured, they would ask her if there were other witches in the village making magic with her. And in her weakness, she might blurt out any name that came into her head, in the hope that the torture would stop. Then others, in their turn, would be arrested and tortured until they confessed and were burned. Fear of the devil and witchcraft were rife during the dreadful period after the 30 Years' War. In Catholic and Protestant districts alike, thousands and thousands of people were burned. The few Jesuit priests who protested against this madness were powerless to stop it. People in those days lived in a state of constant fear of the unknown, of magical powers and the works of the devil. Only this fear can begin to explain the atrocities inflicted on so many thousands of innocent people. What is most remarkable, however, is that at a time when people were at their most superstitious, there were still some who had not forgotten the ideas of Leonardo da Vinci and the other great Florentines. People who went on using their eyes in order to see and make sense of the world. And it was they who discovered the real magic, magic that lets us look into the past and into the future, and enables us to work out what a star billions of miles away is made of, and to predict precisely when an eclipse of the sun is due, and from what part of the earth it will be visible. This magic was arithmetic. Of course, these people didn't invent it, for merchants had always been able to add and subtract. But they became increasingly aware of the number of things in nature that are governed by mathematical laws. How a clock with a pendulum 981 millimeters long needs exactly 1 second per swing, and why this is so. They called these the laws of nature. Leonardo da Vinci had already said that nature doesn't break her own laws. And so it was known with certainty that if you take any natural event and measure and record it precisely, you will discover that, given the same circumstances, the result will always be the same, no matter how often it is repeated. Indeed, it cannot be different. This was an extraordinary discovery, and a far greater magic than anything the poor witches were accused of. For now the whole of nature, the stars and drops of water, falling stones and vibrating violin strings, was no longer just one incomprehensible tangle that made people fearful and uneasy. If you knew the correct mathematical formula, you had a magic spell for everything. You could say to a violin string, "To make an A, you must be this long and this tight, and move backwards and forwards 435 times in a second." And the note the string made would prove it. The first man to understand the extraordinary magical power of applying mathematical calculation to things in nature was an Italian called Galileo Galilei. He had devoted many years to observing, analyzing, and describing such things when, one day, someone denounced him for writing exactly what Leonardo had observed but not explained. What he had written was this: "The sun does not move. On the contrary, it is the earth which moves round the sun, together with the planets." This discovery had already been made by a Polish scholar named Copernicus, after many years of calculation. It had been published in 1543, not long after Leonardo's death and shortly before his own. But the theory had been denounced as unchristian and heretical by Catholic and Protestant priests alike. They pointed to a passage in the Old Testament in which Joshua, the great warrior, asks God not to let dusk fall until his enemy is destroyed. In answer to his prayer, we read, "The sun stood still and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves on their enemies." If the Bible says the sun stood still, people argued, then the sun must normally be in motion. And to suggest that the sun did not move was therefore heretical and contradicted what was written in the Bible. So, in 1632, when he was nearly 70 years old, Galileo, who had devoted his whole life to scholarship, was brought before the religious tribunal known as the Inquisition, and made to choose between being burned as a heretic or renouncing his theory about the movement of the earth around the sun. He signed a declaration saying that he was but a poor sinner, for he had taught that the earth moved round the sun. In this way he avoided being burned, the fate of so many of his predecessors. Nevertheless, when he had signed the declaration, he is said to have muttered under his breath, "And yet it moves." None of these fixed ideas was, in the end, able to prevent Galileo's ideas and methods and all the discoveries he made from influencing and inspiring people in ever-increasing numbers. And if today, thanks to mathematical formulas, we can make nature do whatever we want, so that we have telephones, aeroplanes, and computers, and all the rest of our modern technology, we should be grateful to all those who, like Galileo, investigated nature's mathematical laws at a time when it was almost as dangerous a thing to do as it was to be a Christian in Nero's day. Chapter 31. An Unlucky King and a Lucky King. The only important country not to join in the fighting of the 30 Years' War was England. Lucky English, you may say. But they too were going through troubled times, even if the end, when it came, was not as devastating as it was in Germany. Now you may remember that in 1215 King John of England signed a great charter of liberties, the Magna Carta, in which he made a solemn promise that he and his successors would never act without first consulting the barons and the nobility. For nearly 400 years English monarchs kept this promise, until one day a new king, Charles I, the grandson of the beheaded Mary Stuart, came to the throne, and he didn't wish to abide by the agreement. He disliked having to consult the nobility and the elected members of his parliament. He preferred to govern as he pleased, and this cost the country a great deal of money. The English didn't like it at all. Many of them were strict and zealous Protestants, called Puritans, who had a deep loathing for all forms of wealth and display. A farmer and member of Parliament named Oliver Cromwell was their leader in the conflict that eventually broke out between Parliament supporters and those of the king, which split the country in two. People called Cromwell's supporters roundheads because they wore their hair close-cropped, unlike the long-haired royalists who were known as cavaliers. Cromwell was a deeply religious man and a brave, determined, and ruthless commander. His soldiers were well trained and no less ardent than he was. After many battles, the king was taken prisoner and brought to trial at Westminster, where he was charged with high treason. He refused to recognize the court and made no effort to defend himself, for he believed that only God could be the judge of the King of England. Charles was sentenced to death, and in 1649 he was beheaded. Oliver Cromwell then ruled England, not as king, but as Lord Protector of the Commonwealth, as he described himself. And this wasn't just a title, because it is exactly what he did. Following in Elizabeth's footsteps, he devoted himself to increasing England's power through her colonies in America and trading settlements in India, and by building a strong fleet and expanding sea trade, and did his utmost to weaken England's Dutch neighbours. After his death, however, King soon ruled England once again. But government was now less difficult than it had been before, and went on becoming easier. And since that time, no other English monarch has ever dared break the ancient promises laid down in the Magna Carta. It was easier for the kings of France. There they had no great charter. Moreover, they ruled over a prosperous, well-populated country which was in no danger of collapse, even after the terrible wars of religion. But above all, at the time of the 30 Years' War, the real ruler of France had been that formidably gifted minister, Cardinal Richelieu. He achieved at least as much for France as Cromwell did for England, if not more. Richelieu had been especially good at winning over the knights and the nobility. Through skill and cunning, like a good chess player who knows how to exploit every move and turn a small advantage into a greater one, he gradually reduced their powers until he was able to assume them all himself, including, as you saw, the power of France in Europe. And because he had helped weaken the German Emperor in the 30 Years' War, and because Spain had been reduced to poverty and Italy dismembered, and because England wasn't yet very powerful, by the time Richelieu died, France was the dominant country in Europe. A year after the Cardinal's death, in 1643, King Louis XIV ascended the throne. He was then 4 years old, and still holds the world record for the length of his reign. He ruled until 1715, that is, for 72 years. And what's more, he really did rule. Not, of course, when he was a child, but as soon as his guardian, Cardinal Mazarin, had died — Mazarin had been Cardinal Richelieu's successor — he was determined to rule himself. He gave orders that no passport was to be issued to any Frenchman unless he himself had granted it. The court was highly amused, imagining his interest to be no more than a young king's whim. He would soon tire of ruling. But he didn't. For to Louis, kingship was no mere accident of birth. It was as if he had been given the leading role in a play which he would have to perform for the rest of his life. No one before or since has ever learnt that role so well, or played it with such dignity and ceremony to the end. All the powers that Richelieu and later Mazarin had held, Louis XIV now took upon himself. The nobility had few rights other than that of watching him perform his role. This solemn performance, the so-called lever, began early, at 8 o'clock in the morning, when he deigned to rise. First to enter the bedchamber were the royal princes of the blood, together with the chamberlain and the doctor. Then two great curled and powdered wigs, like flowing manes, were ceremoniously extended to him on bended knee. Depending on his inclination, he chose one, and then inserted himself into a magnificent dressing-gown before seating himself beside the bed. Only at this point were the noblemen of highest rank, the dukes, permitted to enter the bedchamber. And while the king was shaved, his secretaries, officers, and various officials all entered in their turn. After which the doors were thrown wide to admit a host of splendid dignitaries, marshals, governors, princes of the church, and royal favourites, all there to gaze with admiration upon the solemn spectacle of His Majesty the King getting dressed. Everything was regulated down to the last detail. The greatest honour was to be permitted to offer the king his shirt, which had first been carefully warmed. This honour belonged to the king's brother, or, in his absence, to the person next in rank. The chamberlain held one sleeve, a duke the other, and the king inserted himself. And so it went on, until the king was fully dressed, in brightly coloured silk stockings, silk knee breeches, a satin brocade doublet, and a sky-blue sash, with his sword at his side, and an embroidered coat, and a lace collar which a high official with the title of Guardian of the King's Collars held out to him on a silver tray. The king then left his bedchamber, plumed hat on his head and cane in hand, smiling and elegant, to make his entry into the great hall, with a well-turned and courteous greeting for each, while all those around gaped at him with awe-struck expressions, and declared that today he was more beautiful than the sun-god Apollo, stronger than Hercules, hero of the ancient Greeks. He was the god-given sun itself, le roi soleil, the sun-king, on whose warmth and light all life depended. Just like the pharaoh, you might think, for he had been called the son of the sun. But there was one big difference. The ancient Egyptians really believed it, while for Louis XIV it was only a sort of game, which he and everyone present knew was no more than a ceremonious, well-rehearsed and magnificent performance. In his antechamber, after morning prayers, the king announced the program for the day. There then followed many hours of real work, which he undertook in order to have personal control over all affairs of state. Apart from this, there was a lot of hunting, and there were balls and theatrical productions by great poets and actors, which the court enjoyed, and which he, too, always attended. Every meal involved a ceremony no less wearisome and solemn than the levée, and even his going to bed was a complicated ballet-like production that gave rise to some comical moments. For example, everyone had to bow to the king's bed, like the faithful before the altar in church, even when the king wasn't in it. And whenever the king played cards and made conversation, there was always a swarm of people standing around him at a respectful distance, hanging on his every word. To dress like the king, to carry one's cane as he did, to wear one's hat as he did, to sit and move as he did, was the aim of all men at court. And that of the women was to please him. They wore lace collars and ample rustling robes made of the richest fabrics and were adorned with precious jewels. Life revolved around court and was staged in the most magnificent palaces anyone had ever seen. For palaces were Louis XIV's great passion. He had one called Versailles built for himself outside Paris. It was almost as big as a town, with an infinite number of rooms covered in gold and damask, and crystal chandeliers, mirrors in their thousands, and furniture that was all gilded curves, upholstered in velvets and silks. The walls were hung with splendid paintings where people could see Louis in many guises. There is one that shows him dressed as Apollo, receiving homage from all the peoples of Europe. Grander still than the palace was its park. Everything about it was magnificent, elaborate, and theatrical. No tree might grow as it pleased, no bush retain its natural form. Everything green was clipped, trimmed, and shaped into walls of green foliage, curved hedges, vast lawns and spiralling flower-beds, avenues and circuses set with statues, lakes, and fountains. Forced to live out their lives at court, once mighty dukes and their ladies strolled up and down white gravel paths, exchanging witty and well-turned phrases on the way the Swedish ambassador had recently performed his bow, and things of that sort. Just think what such a palace and such a way of life must have cost. The king had 200 servants for himself alone, and that was only the start of it. But Louis XIV had clever ministers, mainly men of humble origin, chosen for their outstanding ability. These men were all experts at extracting money from the country. They kept tight control of foreign trade and encouraged France's own crafts and industry as much as they could. But the true cost fell on the peasants, who were burdened with crippling taxes and duties of all kinds. And while at court people ate off gold and silver dishes piled high with the choicest delicacies, the peasants ate scraps and weeds. But it wasn't life at court which cost the most. Far more expensive were the wars that Louis XIV kept waging, often with no other purpose than to increase his own power at the expense of the neighbouring states. With his immense and well-equipped army, he invaded both Holland and Germany, seizing, for example, Strasbourg from the Germans, without offering any real pretext for his actions. He saw himself as the master of all Europe, which, in a sense, he was. All the great men of Europe imitated him. Soon every German prince, even those who owned no more than a miserable patch of land, had his own gigantic castle in the style of Versailles, with all the gold and damask, the clipped hedges, the men in great wigs, the powdered ladies in voluminous gowns, the courtiers and the flatterers. They tried to imitate him in every way, but there was always something missing. They were what Louis XIV only played at being, somewhat comical puppet kings with pompous airs and glittering fancy dress. Louis XIV himself was more than that. and in case you don't believe me, I'm going to quote something from a letter he wrote to his grandson when his grandson was leaving to become King of Spain. "Never favour those who flatter you most, but hold rather to those who risk your displeasure for your own good. Never neglect business for pleasure. Organise your life so that there is time in it for relaxation and entertainment. Give the business of government your full attention. Inform yourself as much as you can before taking any decision. Make every effort to get to know men of distinction so that you may call on them when you need them. Be courteous to all. Speak hurtfully to no man." These really were the guiding principles of King Louis XIV of France, that remarkable mixture of vanity, charm, extravagance, dignity, indifference, frivolity, and sheer hard work. Chapter 32. Meanwhile, looking eastwards, while Louis XIV was holding court in Paris and Versailles, Germany suffered a new misfortune, the Turks. As you know, more than 200 years earlier, in 1453, they had conquered Constantinople and established a great Muslim empire known as the Ottoman Empire, incorporating Egypt, Palestine, Mesopotamia, Asia Minor, and Greece. In other words, the whole of the ancient Roman Empire of the East, of whose magnificence and splendour, it must be said, not much remained. Under their great leader, Suleiman the Magnificent, they had then pushed onwards beyond the Danube and defeated the Hungarian army in 1526. Almost every Hungarian nobleman, including the king, had been killed. Having conquered the better part of Hungary, the Turks had tried to take Vienna, but they soon turned back. As you remember, their fleet had been destroyed in 1571 by King Philip II of Spain and his Venetian allies. But they were still a powerful state, and a Turkish pasha, or governor, was ruling in Budapest. Now, many Hungarians were Protestants, and when their king had been killed, they had become unwilling subjects of the Catholic emperor, and had fought against him during the religious wars. After the 30 Years' War, these uprisings continued, until one day the Hungarian nobility asked their Turkish neighbours for help. The Sultan, as the Turkish ruler was called, was only too happy to respond to this request. For a long while he had been wanting a war, because his soldiers and warriors had become too powerful at home. He was afraid that he would lose control of them, and was delighted to be able to send them off to fight. If they won, so much the better, and if they lost, he would be rid of them. You can see what sort of a person he was. So in 1683 he mobilized a huge army from all four corners of his empire. The pashas of Mesopotamia and Egypt brought their soldiers, and Tatars, Arabs, Greeks, Hungarians, and Romanians all assembled in Constantinople under the leadership of the Grand Vizier, or Prime Minister, Kara Mustafa, and prepared to march on Austria. There were more than 200,000 of them, armed to the teeth and dressed in exotic and colourful costumes and turbans with banners bearing their sign, the Crescent Moon. The Emperor's armies stationed in Hungary were in no position to withstand such an assault. They retreated and left the way to Vienna open to the Turks. Like all towns at that time, Vienna had fortifications at the ready. These were now hastily put in place, and cannon and supplies brought in. 20,000 soldiers were to hold the city until the Emperor and his allies came to their aid. But the Emperor and his court had fled, first to Linz and then to Passau. And when the Viennese saw smoke rising from distant villages and suburbs set on fire by the Turks, some 60,000 people abandoned the city, in an unending stream of carts and carriages. Now the Turkish cavalry arrived. Their gigantic army ringed Vienna and began firing cannonballs at the walls and undermining them with explosives. The Viennese fought back with all their might. A month went by. With each day the danger increased as more and more breaches appeared in the walls, and still no help came. Terrible outbreaks of disease began to sweep through the town, far more deadly than the Turkish bullets. Supplies of food were running low, despite daring sorties by soldiers who sometimes returned with an ox or two. As time went on, people found themselves paying 20 or 30 crowns for a cat, no small sum in those days for such unappetizing fare. The walls were on the verge of collapse when the imperial troops finally reached Vienna. The Viennese could breathe at last. However, the imperial troops from Austria and Germany hadn't come on their own. the Polish king, Jan Sobieski, who had previously signed an alliance with the emperor against the Turks, had declared himself willing to help in return for significant concessions. These included the honor of supreme command, which the emperor wanted himself, so precious time was lost in negotiation. In the end, Sobieski's army took up position on the heights above Vienna, and from there charged down upon the Turks. After fierce fighting, the Turks fled without even taking the time to decamp, leaving rich pickings for the imperial soldiers. The camp, consisting of 40,000 tents set out in neat straight lines separated by narrow lanes, was just like a small town and a truly magnificent sight. The Turks continued to retreat. Had they succeeded in taking Vienna, the situation would have been almost as bad as if the Muslim Arabs had defeated Charles Martel at Tours and Poitiers 1,000 years earlier. However, the imperial troops pushed them further and further back, while Sobieski's men went home. A distinguished French general was to lead the Austrian army in this triumphant pursuit. This was Prince Eugène of Savoy, a man whom Louis XIV wouldn't have in his army on account of his plain appearance. In the years that followed, he took country after country from the Turks. The Sultan was forced to give up all of Hungary, which then became part of Austria. These victories brought much wealth and power to the imperial court at Vienna, and now Austria too began to build magnificent castles and many fine monasteries in a sparkling new style which they called Baroque. Meanwhile, Turkish power continued to decline, not least because a new and mighty enemy had appeared behind them. This was Russia. Until now we have heard nothing about Russia. It was a vast wilderness of forests, with great steppes in the north. The landowners ruled the poor peasants with terrible cruelty, and the sovereign ruled the landowners with, if anything, greater cruelty. One of Russia's czars, around 1580, was known as Ivan the Terrible. And rightly so. Beside him Nero was mild. In those days Russians took little notice of Europe and what went on there. They were too busy fighting among themselves and killing each other. Although they were Christians, they didn't come under the Pope's authority. Their spiritual leader was the bishop or patriarch of the Roman Empire of the East in Constantinople, so they didn't have a great deal to do with the West. In 1689, that is, 6 years after the Turkish siege of Vienna, a new Tsar came to the throne. This was Peter, known as Peter the Great. He was no less barbarous or cruel than many of his predecessors, nor was he any less fond of drinking or less violent. But he was determined to model his empire on Western states, like France, England, or the German Empire. He knew what was needed, money, trade, and cities. But how had other countries acquired these? So he went to find out. In Holland he saw great seaports with mighty ships that sailed as far as India and America to do business. He wanted ships like these, and he needed to know how they were made. Without a second thought, he took a job as a ship's carpenter, first in a Dutch shipyard and later in the dockyard of the Royal Navy in England, to learn the art himself. Then he went home, taking with him a team of skilled craftsmen to build his ships. All he needed now was a seaport. So he gave orders for one to be built, a city on the sea, just like those he'd seen in Holland. The coast to the north of Russia, however, was nothing but barren marshland, and actually belonged to Sweden, with which Peter the Great was at war. This didn't deter him. Peasants were rounded up from the surrounding countryside and made to drain the swamps and drive piles into the ground. He had 80,000 labourers toiling there, and soon a real seaport rose up out of the marshes. He named it St. Petersburg. Next, Russians had to be made into true Europeans. They had to stop wearing their traditional long-skirted kaftans and weren't allowed to grow their hair and beards long. From now on, they were to dress like Frenchmen or Germans. Anyone who protested or disagreed with Peter's innovations was flogged and then executed. Even his own son. He was not a nice man, but he achieved what he wanted. The Russians may not have become Europeans overnight, but they were now ready to enter the field as players in Europe's bloody contest for power. Peter the Great made the first move. He attacked Sweden, which, following the victories of Gustavus Adolphus in the Thirty Years' War, had become the mightiest state in northern Europe. Sweden's ruler in Peter's time may not have had the piety or the perspicacity of Gustavus Adolphus, but he was one of the most extraordinary adventurers the world has ever known. The young King Charles XII came to power in 1697. He might have leapt straight out of the pages of the popular adventure books that left me spellbound as a boy in Vienna. His exploits can hardly be believed. He was as foolhardy as he was brave, and that's saying something. He and his army fought Peter the Great and defeated an army 5 times as strong as his own. Then he conquered Poland and pushed straight on into Russia without bothering to wait for another Swedish army, which was on its way to assist him. On he went, deeper and deeper into Russia, always at the head of his troops, wading through rivers and trudging through swamps, without ever meeting any resistance from the Russian army. Autumn came, and then winter, the bitter, biting cold Russian winter, and still Charles XII had had no chance to prove his courage against the enemy. Only when his men were half-dead with hunger, cold, and exhaustion did the Russians finally appear and inflict a massive defeat on them. This was in 1709. Forced to flee, Charles made for Turkey. There he remained for 5 years, vainly trying to persuade the Turks to go to war with Russia. Eventually, in 1714, news reached him from Sweden that his subjects had had enough of their king's adventures in Turkey. The nobility were about to elect a new ruler. Disguised as a German officer and with only one attendant, Charles crossed the Turkish frontier without delay, and, riding as fast as he could by day and sleeping in mail coaches by night, raced back to Stralsund in North Germany, in those days part of Sweden, in a mad 16-day journey that involved all sorts of perilous adventures as they passed through enemy territory. Roused from his bed, the governor of the fortress could scarcely believe his eyes when he saw his king standing before him, for like everyone else, he thought he was somewhere in Turkey. The town was delighted with Charles XII's dramatic appearance, but Charles simply fell into bed and slept for a very long time. His feet were so swollen from his long ride that his boots had to be cut off him. But there was no more talk of electing a new king. Charles hadn't been back in Sweden long before he embarked on a new military adventure. He made enemies of England, Germany, Norway, and Denmark. Norway was first on his list. He died while besieging a Norwegian fortress in 1718, shot, some say, by someone on his own side, because the country simply would not tolerate any more wars. With this enemy out of the way, Peter the Great, who now called himself Emperor of all the Russias, was able to increase his empire's might, expanding in all directions into Europe, into Turkey, into Persia, and into the countries of Asia. Chapter 33. A Truly New Age. If you could talk to a gentleman from the time of the Turkish siege, there would be many things about him that would surprise you. The way he spoke, and the many Latin and French words he used. His elaborate and convoluted turns of phrase, and habit of slipping in Latin quotations that neither you nor I could place, and his grand and solemn bows. You would, I think, suspect that beneath that venerable wig was someone with a large appetite for good food and fine wines. And, if you will forgive me for mentioning it, you could hardly fail to notice that beneath the fancy lace, the embroidery, and the silk, this prinked, perfumed, and powdered gentleman stank, because he hardly ever washed. But nothing could prepare you for the shock you would have if he were to begin to air his views. All children should be thrashed. Young girls, no more than children, should be married, and to men they barely know. A peasant's lot is to toil and not complain. Beggars and tramps should be whipped and put in chains in the marketplace for everyone to mock. Thieves should be hanged, and murderers publicly chopped into pieces. Witches and the other harmful sorcerers that infest the country should be burnt. People of different beliefs should be persecuted, treated as outcasts, or thrown into dark dungeons. A comet seen recently in the sky must mean bad times ahead, as protection against the coming plague, which has already claimed many victims in Venice, it would be sensible to wear a red armband. And finally, a Mr. So-and-so, an English friend, has an excellent and well-established business selling Negroes from Africa to America as slaves. A brainwave of that most worthy gentleman since, as we all know, American Indian convicts don't take well to manual labor. And you would hear these opinions not only from the mouth of some coarse or uncouth fellow, but from the most intelligent and pious people in all walks of life and from all nations. Only after 1700 did things gradually change. The widespread and terrible suffering that Europeans endured during the wretched wars of religion had made some people wonder if it was really right to judge someone by his or her religious belief. Was it not more important to be a good and honest human being? Would it not be better if people got on with one another, regardless of any differences of opinion or belief that they might have? Better if they respected one another and tolerated each other's convictions? This was the first and most important idea that the people who thought about such things now voiced, the principle of tolerance. Only in matters of religion could there be differences of opinion. No rational person disputes the fact that 2 + 2 = 4. Therefore, reason, or sound common sense, as they also termed it, is what can and should unite all men. In the realm of reason, you can use arguments to convince others of the rightness of your opinions, whereas another's religious beliefs, being beyond rational argument, should be respected and tolerated. And so reason was the second most important thing to these people. Clear and reasoned thinking about mankind and nature was rediscovered in the works of the ancient Greeks and Romans, and in those of the Florentines during the time of the Renaissance. But, more than anywhere else, it was to be found in the works of men like Galileo, who had boldly set out to investigate the magic of nature's mathematical formulas. Differences of belief played no part in these things. There was only experiment and proof. Reason alone could explain the appearance of nature and the workings of the universe. Reason, which is given in equal measure to all mankind the world over. Now, if reason is given to all, it must follow that all people are of equal worth. And, as you remember, that was just what Christianity had taught, that all men are equal before God. But those who preached tolerance and reason took this argument one step further. They didn't only teach that all people were essentially equal, they demanded that they be treated equally as well. That every human being, as God's creature, endowed by him with reason, had rights that no one might or should deny him. The right to choose his own calling, and to choose how he lived. And the freedom to act or not to act as his reason and his conscience dictated. Children, too, should not be taught with the cane, but with reason, so that they might come to understand the difference between right and wrong. And criminals were human beings, too. No doubt they had done wrong, but they could still be helped to mend their ways. It was dreadful, they argued, to brand a man's cheek or forehead with a red-hot iron for one wrongdoing, leaving a mark he would bear for the rest of his life, so that all might say, "That man is a criminal." There was something, they said, which forbade a person to be publicly humiliated. It was called human dignity. All these ideas, which from 1700 onwards were debated first in England and later in France, came to be called the Enlightenment, because the people who held them wanted to combat the darkness of superstition with the pure light of reason. Many people today think that the Enlightenment only taught what was obvious, and that people in those days had a rather simple view of the great mysteries of nature and the world. This is true. But you must realize that what seems obvious to us wasn't in the least so then, and that it took a great deal of courage, self-sacrifice, and perseverance for people to keep on repeating them so that they seem obvious to us today. And, of course, you must also realize that reason cannot and never will give us the key to all mysteries, although it has often put us on the right track. In the 200 years that followed the Enlightenment, more mysteries of nature were studied and explained than in the preceding 2000 years. But what you must never forget is the importance for our own lives of tolerance, reason, and humanity, the three fundamental principles of the Enlightenment. Because of them, we no longer take someone suspected of having committed a crime and torture them inhumanly on the rack until, half out of their wits, they confess to anything we want. Reason has taught us that there's no such thing as witchcraft, so no more witches are burnt at the stake. The last time a woman was convicted of witchcraft in England was in 1712. Diseases are no longer fought by superstitious means, but mainly through cleanliness and the scientific investigation of their causes. We don't have slaves or peasant serfs anymore. All citizens are subject to the same laws, and women have the same rights as men. All this we owe to the brave citizens and writers who dared stand up for these ideas. And it was daring. They may have lacked understanding and behaved unjustly in their struggle with ancient and long-held traditions, but they fought a long and hard battle to win tolerance, reason, and humanity. The battle would have taken much longer and involved far greater sacrifices if some of Europe's rulers hadn't fought in the front line for the ideas of the Enlightenment. One of the first to do so was Frederick the Great, King of Prussia. As you know, the title of emperor, passed down through several generations of Habsburgs, was by this time not much more than a venerable title. The Habsburgs' only real power was over Austria, Hungary, and Bohemia, whereas in Germany, power was in the hands of numerous princes who ruled over Bavaria, Saxony, and many other big and small states. The Protestant lands in the north were among those which had paid the least attention to the Catholic emperor in Vienna since the Thirty Years' War, and the most powerful of these princedoms was Prussia. Since the reign of its great sovereign Frederick William I, who ruled from 1640 to 1688, Prussia had taken more and more land from Sweden, until finally, in 1701, its princes had declared themselves kings. Prussia was a severe warrior state, whose nobility knew no greater honour than to serve as officers in the distinguished army of their king. Now, since 1740, Prussia had been under the rule of its third king, Frederick II, who was a member of the Hohenzollern family. Known as Frederick the Great, he was, without doubt, one of the most cultivated men of his age. He was on friendly terms with a number of Frenchmen who preached the ideas of the Enlightenment in their writings, and he himself wrote much on the subject in French. For although he was King of Prussia, he scorned the German language and customs, which, as a result of the Thirty Years' War, were in a very poor state. His aim and his duty, as he saw it, was to make Prussia a model state, and in so doing demonstrate the value of the thinking of his friends in France. He liked to say that he saw himself as the first servant of the state, the butler, as it were, rather than the owner. And in that role he concerned himself with every detail of his project of putting the new ideas into practice. One of the first things he did was to abolish the barbaric practice of torture. He also relieved the peasants of some of the heavier duties to their landlords. And he was always particularly concerned that all his subjects, from the poorest to the mightiest, should receive equal justice. A rare thing in those days. But, above all, Frederick wanted to make Prussia the mightiest of all the German states and destroy Austria's imperial power. He didn't foresee any difficulty in this. Austria was ruled by a woman, the Empress Maria Theresa. When she came to the throne in 1740, aged only 23, Frederick thought it a suitable moment to remove one of the empire's possessions. So he took his well-trained army to the province of Silesia and seized it. From that time on, he would spend most of the rest of his life fighting the Empress of Austria. The state of his army was always of the utmost importance to him. He drilled his troops unremittingly until he had the best army in the world. But Maria Theresa was a far more formidable opponent than he had first thought, although no warmonger at heart. She was deeply religious and, first and foremost, a mother. She had 16 children in all. Although Frederick was her enemy, she followed his example in introducing many of his reforms in Austria as well. Like him, she abolished torture, made the peasants' lives easier, and took a special interest in establishing good education throughout the land. She genuinely saw herself as a mother to her people, and never pretended to know all the answers herself. She chose the ablest people to be her advisers, among them men quite capable of holding their own against Frederick during the long wars, not only on the battlefield, but also as envoys to all the courts of Europe, where they won sympathy for her cause. Even France, which for centuries had taken sides against the empire, was eventually won over, after which Maria Theresa gave her daughter, Marie Antoinette, in marriage to the future King Louis XVI of France, as a pledge of their new friendship. Frederick now found himself surrounded by enemies on all sides, Austria, France, Sweden, and Russia, now a vast and mighty empire. Without waiting for them to declare war on him, he occupied Saxony, which was also hostile. He then went on to wage a bitter war that lasted 7 long years, in which his only support came from the British. But his perseverance paid off, for despite the superior strength of his enemies, not only did he not lose the war, he even managed to hold on to Silesia. From 1765, Maria Theresa ceased to rule Austria alone. Her son Joseph ruled with her and succeeded her after her death as Emperor Joseph II. He was an even more zealous fighter for the ideas of the Enlightenment than either Frederick or his mother. Tolerance, reason, and humanity were all that mattered to him. He abolished the death sentence and peasant serfdom. Protestants were once again allowed to worship freely, and although a good Catholic himself, he confiscated some of the lands and wealth of the Catholic Church. He was an invalid, and, knowing that he might not have long to rule, he did everything with such zeal, such impatience, and such haste, that it was often all too quick, too unexpected, and altogether too much for his subordinates to endure. He had many admirers, but his people loved him less than they loved his more cautious and pious mother. At the same time as Austria and Germany were witnessing the triumph of the ideas of the Enlightenment, in America the inhabitants of many British colonies were refusing to be British subjects any longer, or to pay taxes to Britain. In their fight for independence, they were led by Benjamin Franklin, an ordinary citizen who spent much of his time studying the natural sciences, in the course of which he invented the lightning conductor. He was a plain and upright man, energetic and hard-working. Under his leadership and that of another American, George Washington, the British colonies and trading ports organized themselves into a confederation and, after a long struggle, drove the British soldiers from their shores. Now they too could adopt the principles of the new way of thinking. In 1776, they declared the sacred rights of all men to liberty and equality to be the founding principles of their new state. But for the Negro slaves on their plantations, life simply went on as before. Chapter 34. A Very Violent Revolution. All countries felt the ideas of the Enlightenment to be just and fair, and ruled accordingly. Even the Empress of Russia, Catherine the Great, regularly exchanged letters with the French thinkers of the Enlightenment. The only exceptions were the kings of France, who behaved as if they neither knew nor cared about the new ideas. Louis XV and Louis XVI, the Sun King's successors, were incompetent, and content merely to imitate their great predecessors' outward show of power. The pomp and magnificence remained. Vast sums were spent on entertainments and operatic productions, on a succession of new chateaus and great parks with clipped hedges, on swarms of servants and court officials dressed in lace and silk. Where the money came from didn't concern them. Finance ministers soon became expert swindlers, cheating and extorting on a grand scale. The peasants worked till they dropped, and citizens were forced to pay huge taxes. Meanwhile, at court, amid exchanges that were not always light-hearted and witty, the nobility dissipated and gambled the money away. But if a noble landowner happened to leave the palace and go home to his estate, it was even worse for the peasants, for he and his attendants would rampage across the land after hares and foxes, their horses' hooves trampling the carefully tended fields. And woe betide the peasant who protested. He would be lucky to escape with a few blows across the face from his lord's riding whip, for a noble landowner was also his peasant's judge, and could punish him as he pleased. A landowner who enjoyed the king's favour could obtain a note from him which simply said, "Mr. Blank is to be imprisoned," signed King Louis XV. The nobleman wrote in the name himself, so that anyone who displeased him for any reason whatsoever was simply made to disappear. But at court, these lords were elegant, prinked, powdered, and perfumed, rustling in their robes of silk and lace. Weary of the heavy pomp and splendour of Louis XIV's time, they favoured a lighter, less formal way of speaking. Instead of their full-bottomed wigs, they now wore light, white, powdered ones with a little plait at the back. No one could dance and bow better than they, unless it was their ladies, tight-laced in their corsets, the skirts of their crinolines billowing and round like giant bells. And while all these fine lords and ladies strolled in the gardens of the royal palaces, their estates decayed and the peasants starved. Yet even they sometimes tired of such an unnatural life that was all elegance and sophistication. So they invented a new pastime. They played at simplicity and nature. This consisted of living in charming shepherds' huts, which they had built in the grounds of their chateaus, and giving themselves the names of shepherds and shepherdesses taken from Greek poems. What could be more natural or more simple? Into this bright confusion of elegance, gracefulness, and over-refinement came Maria Theresa's daughter, Marie Antoinette. She was a very young girl, barely 14 years old, when she became the wife of the future King of France. And, of course, she thought everything was as it should be. She threw herself delightedly into all the fairy-tale masked balls and operas. She acted in plays. She was an enchanting shepherdess, and thought life in the French royal palaces was altogether wonderful. Nevertheless, her elder brother, the Emperor Joseph II, and her mother repeatedly warned her to live simply and to avoid stirring up further resentment among the poor with foolish extravagance and frivolity. In 1777, the Emperor Joseph wrote her a long and serious letter, saying, "Things cannot go on like this. There will be a terrible revolution if you do not do something to prevent it." Yet things did go on like that for 12 more years. And the revolution, when it came, was all the more terrible for it. By then, the court had squandered all the country's wealth. Nothing was left with which to pay for the monstrous daily extravagances. In 1789, King Louis XVI finally decided to summon a meeting of the three estates, the nobility, the clergy, and the bourgeoisie.